so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with an old friend, Charles Goodhart. He's a professor emeritus of the Financial Markets Group at the London School of Economics. He co-founded the Financial Markets Group with Mervyn King, and he's been involved in almost every interesting book, vision, conversation related to central banking and financial markets regulation since the time, well, since before the time I started paying attention, but certainly as of the time I joined the staff of the United States Senate Banking Committee in the 1980s. He and I worked together on the Stiglitz Commission at the United Nations during the Great Financial Crisis Resolution, and he's been a profound influence on the formation and the direction of INET. He's here today with his co-author and colleague, Manoj Pradhan, who founded Talking Heads Economics. It's a macroeconomic consulting and business advisory firm. And Manoj was previously at Morgan Stanley as the head of the Global Economics Group, and prior to that, as a professor at Stony Brook in New York State. Charles has worked on many, many projects, including the link between the U.S. and Hong Kong dollar and the whole notion that the Reserve Bank of New Zealand modeled for the world of central bank independence. Together, they have teamed to write what I find to be an extraordinary new book called The Great Demographic Reversal, Aging Societies, Waning Inequality, and an Inflation Revival. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me today. I really look forward to this conversation. The two of you have presented a scenario that is so distinct and different from the dialogue, or what might call the conventional wisdom I hear, whether at central banks and finance ministries or on Wall Street or in the City of London. Let me begin with you, Charles. This book, this scenario, where did the inspiration come from, and what is your sense of purpose in creating a book like this?
I think that the work arose from the realization that there has been the most extraordinary positive supply shock to the availability of labor for those who can place their production wherever they want over the last 30 years. The available labor supply has more than doubled during this period as a result of a combination of globalization, particularly the arrival of China and much of East Asia into the world's trading system, together with the availability of Eastern Europe after the collapse of the Iron Curtain. And that, together with demography, which has led to a increase in the labor supply as the baby boomers entered and remained in the workforce, and the dependency ratio declined as the number of children declined faster over the last 30 years than the rise in the number of the old. Now, when you get a huge positive labor supply shock of this particular kind, you are almost inevitably going to have a massive disinflationary force as production shifts from the more expensive of good manufactured goods in particular, from the more expensive areas to particularly China. And the shift in the production of goods from the West to China over these last 30 years has been dramatic, and the resulting decline in the cost of goods has been a major factor in the continuing disinflation. Naturally, with a huge surge in the availability of labor, it has meant that the returns to labor in the form of real wages over these last years has declined for those who are relatively unskilled. There are, of course, those who have high skills, complementary with capital, have had an extremely successful time. And one of the problems that we find, or a number of the problems that we find with the mainstream economics, the first one is that the disinflation that we've seen over these last 30 years frequently is not actually properly explained at all. And the second major problem that we find with the mainstream is they tend to disregard and ignore the effects of population change, demography, and dependency ratios, because these change relatively slowly over time. Most forecasting is done over a time period, a horizon of about 2 to 3 years, maybe three at the outside, at the outset. And over such a relatively short period, demography and globalization can be often taken pretty much for granted as being unchanged. But when you're talking in terms of decades, of course, these long, slow but longer acting forces tend to have a much more dramatic effect. Now, the point that we are making in our book is that these major trends of demographic trends the globalization are at the moment at a turning point. They're reversing quite sharply. I don't think any need to remind everybody about the effect of the disputes and concerns about the relationship between the US and China and how that is affecting the world. And also the coronavirus pandemic, which took place after the bulk of our book has actually been written, is going to accelerate the withdrawal away from globalization. Moreover, China is again a absolutely key feature of both the demographic and the globalization effects, in that the Chinese workforce, which was huge to begin with, effectively became even larger as a result of the massive migration from the interior in subsistence farming to the coastal areas where they participated in the increase in manufacturing production. Moreover, the one-child policy, which has been continued for far too long, is going to bring about a really quite sharp reduction in the Chinese labor force. So that if you look at the chart of the availability of labor, excluding Africa, what you find is that it was growing very rapidly indeed in the years up to about 2010, flattened thereafter a bit, and is now about to decline really quite sharply. So that the forces of demography and globalization are about to go into reverse. That is going to mean that all the tendencies for which they were quite largely responsible, disinflation, increased inequality within countries, falling interest rates, and rising asset prices, are, at any rate in our view, likely to move quite sharply into reverse. And the coronavirus pandemic will actually accelerate the whole process. With the one real qualification that we see being that the combination of the incentive structure for capitalism combined with the very sharp reduction in interest rates, both nominal and real, to about the lowest ever in terms of nominal, have led to an absolutely massive increase in debt ratios. The increase in debt ratios has been so large that it will become difficult for central banks to raise nominal interest rates in future without running into the dangers of recession. If the central banks are prevented by political pressure of the kind, for example, that President Trump has will and has been applying to the Fed, are prevented from raising interest rates to prevent inflation taking hold, then what will happen will be a considerably more inflationary future than we've had in the past. So all the trends of the last 30 years, we feel, are on the verge of reversing. To put, if you like, our thesis into a nutshell, we believe that the future will be absolutely nothing like the past 30 years, whereas the mainstream, for the time being, sees the future as purely a continuation of recent trends, and we think that they are just wrong.
Hi, Rob. First, thanks very much for hosting us here. It's a pleasure to be here with you and your listeners. Charles, as always, puts things wonderfully, and I have very little to add to that. I'll just make three very brief points. And one of the key motivations, I think, with the book was many of the key things that we have described here have been tackled individually. The IMF has done a lot of work on interest rates. Everyone has seen the literature on inequality. And deflation has also been addressed. What we thought was particularly striking as my first point was that all three of them have an underlying basis in the evolution of demography over the last 30 years. And so we find it very interesting that people do agree with us on this part of the thesis, is that this large, massive historical labor supply shock that Charles spoke about, they do agree has been responsible for driving inflation, interest rates, wages lower, and inequality higher. But then when we talk about the reversal of the same demographic forces, they abandon that link. And we find that actually the burden of proof somehow still rests upon us to make the case that this link is going to be an enduring one, and the reversal of demography will indeed lead to a reversal of these three trends. The second point is that we get a lot of pushback because most people see Japan as the tip of the spear. They see Japan as a roadmap for what demographics will do to the global economy. However, Japan's evolution itself has to be seen as part of a global dynamic, which I think a lot of people ignore. And we have tried to make that case forcefully in the book. And the final point that I wanted to make is that markets and central banks, as you pointed out in your opening comments, have ignored this, which means if we have seen market reactions in the past, when the surprise is upon us, the change in portfolios and the change in market behavior sometimes leads to very abrupt changes in economics. And this is something that we would like people to be aware of. And these, in a nutshell, some of the main reasons that we put the book out.
Charles, in the beginning, you were describing a number of phenomena that influence the book. And one of the elements in your subtitle is aging societies. And you spoke of the dependency ratio. For our listeners who are not familiar with that term, can you explain a little bit more about what the dependency ratio is and how it affects the scenario that your book explores?
It's a very simple concept. People are dependent when they are young and not working, and they depend on their parents for support. And people are dependent on pensions and when they cease to work because they're retired. Now, the more workers you have, the less the inflation, because you won't hire a worker unless they're going to be producing more than they are paid, which means that the more workers you have, the more disinflation you will have. On the other hand, dependents consume, but they don't produce. And therefore, the higher the more dependents there are relative to workers, the more that you are likely to have too many mouths chasing too few goods. The higher the ratio of dependents, the more likely the world is likely to be a inflationary one. And we're shifting rapidly to a system whereby, because we're all getting older, and which is now beginning to outpace the decline in the young, the dependency ratio is worsening. Just means there are a lot more old people who have to be supported. You've got to transfer resources from the working population, aged between 19 and 65. Manoj will correct me because I can't remember exactly which is year, what the formal date of changing from young to being within the workforce. This is going to be a major influence. And the world is not actually ready for the realization of what an aged society is about to come and hit us. And the other problem is that an aging society also requires a great deal more support, because the diseases of the old, arthritis, Parkinson's, dementia, to name but three, don't kill you, but they make you incapacitated. And people with those kinds of diseases require a great deal more of support from everyone else. The figures of what is known as medical dependency, which is a completely different term, which means those who can't look after themselves, rises exponentially with age. You're very unlucky if you're medically dependent before 65. What is known as the young old, between 65 and 75, the dependency ratio is somewhere, it gets up to about, on average, about 30%. But the old, between 75 and 85, the medical dependency ratio tends to get over 50%, and it goes over about 80% when you become old, over the age of 85. And by the time you get into your late 90s, the dependency ratio gets very, very close to 100%. And the medical dependency ratio requires support from carers.
So on the economics dependency ratio, which Charles spoke about, very simply put, as he said, it's the number of young plus the number of old divided by the number of workers. And the larger that ratio, the greater is the burden upon the workers to make sure that there is more than enough to look after the dependence on them, if you will. But there is one more interesting difference in these dependency ratios is, if the dependency ratio is high because of the young, then in about 15 or 16 years, you can look forward to them joining the labor force. And hence, on that horizon, it actually doesn't feel worrisome to have a high dependency ratio, because in the future, these people will be joining the workforce and they probably will be able to pay for the expenses that they have incurred in the past. What is changing now, as Charles has said, is that the elderly are the ones that are driving this dependency ratio, and they're going to live for much longer than had been anticipated just 15 years ago. Now, that kind of an increase in the dependency ratio is very, very, very difficult to deal with, because if anything, the ability of the elderly to work diminishes along with age. It does not increase.
And the increased medical and pension costs and the decline in the availability of workers in our populations is going to mean that the tax rates on everybody are going to have to rise, and really rise quite dramatically. And that was obvious even before the coronavirus hit. The young now and the younger workers can look forward not only to having to work to well over their 70 on average, but also to a much higher tax burden in order to provide support for the growing army of the infirm and aged.
Let me ask you about, you mentioned, Charles, in your opening portrait, the question of the growth of population outside of Africa. I've seen scenarios recently where the demographic bulge or growth in Africa between now and the end of the century is enormous. Does this imply perhaps that a globalized world will be reaching to the development or to the labor force and some of the aspects of development in Africa to offset this rise in, how would I say, inflation, compression of profits and what have you? Or is that an unlikely response?
The question of how to handle the demographic surge in Africa is going to be one of the key issues of the next 30 years. But Manoj, this is really an area where you have taken the lead, so I'm going to pass this question over to you.
Sure. It's very tempting, if you look at the numbers solely, to think that Africa, with its masses of population and young population still in the future, will be able to offset a lot of the demographic headwinds, if you will, that the rest of the world has. Indeed, if you look even at India, the turn in this dependency ratio in India is still 20 years away from us. So put together, that certainly looks like a formidable opposition to our thesis. However, let's consider how that might come about if it will. So there are clearly two options that you can exercise in order to integrate Africa and possibly India's population into the global supply chain, just as China and Eastern Europe did, as Charles had mentioned earlier. So the first one might be to have an import of people, have a labor flow across borders. But given the political situation that we are in globally, I think we would all agree that this seems next to impossible. It's extremely difficult to think that countries, given the constraints that they find at home and given the political environment we're in, are going to open their doors to allow foreign workers to come in and in an almost unrestricted way. Well, what about then if we take capital from the advanced economies and move them over to emerging markets, particularly to Africa and India? Now, this seems like a much more viable proposition. And in fact, those countries are doing everything that they can to open their doors to allow that capital to flood in. The problem is one of transforming that capital. So if you look at India and Africa, they share a similar size of the population. The areas are vastly different, but Africa as a continent has 50 odd countries that make up this population size. And that means 50 different administrative priorities, immigration challenges, capital passing from one place to the other, and economies of scale can't be reaped. Even if you move across to somewhere like India, where none of these problems exist, the question of administrative capital is the key one. We don't think that either of these areas, Africa or India, are in a position to transform capital as rapidly as was done by China. And given the scale of the demographic challenge that the world faces now, remember that when China integrated with the world actually had demographic tailwinds. Now, we probably might need something like three Chinas. So while Africa and India are, as regions, going to do very well for themselves, we think a lot of transformation is going to happen in both areas. Capital will find its way across there, and they will see persistent growth to the extent that they can manage their administrative capital be upgraded. However, will they be able to do so to an extent that the world needs to offset the constraints in demography that the world sees? We don't think so. Keep in mind that the demographic headwinds that we're going to see over the next few decades are hitting the entire manufacturing base of the world right now. Africa hasn't quite gotten to that stage at all, and India is only in its first steps, even if it wants a share of this manufacturing pie globally. So we are a very, very long way away from making any kind of comfortable statement about these areas offsetting the overall demography that we speak of.
The demographic headwinds are going to be worst in those countries which have been at the absolute forefront of growth in recent years. And it's countries like China, Germany, and much of Western Europe that are going to see the worst declines in labor availability. So the idea that the world is going to grow out of its present debt problems, and it's just not feasible.
Let me, Charles, come back to something that you talked about, which is the political pressures related to a central bank where debt ratios are high. And you mentioned in passing how President Trump has pressured the Federal Reserve in the United States. But in these larger contexts that you're describing, where the prospect of inflation, which you might call, will diminish the value, particularly of long bonds and possibly the equity market, if the central bank succumbs to political pressure, doesn't it ultimately exacerbate the depth of the crisis by not stabilizing inflation?
Well, the question is, what else are you going to do? Remember, there are political limits to raising taxes. There are political limits to cutting public sector expenditures. There are undoubtedly political limits to raising interest rates, given the huge increases in debt ratios. And the world has never seen an increase in debt ratios during peacetime of the kind that we now have. Yes, debt ratios in my own country, the UK, have been a great deal higher, but that was during wars, and wars have always been seen as temporary, and it has always been seen as likely that once the wars were over, the normal decline rate increase in growth would bring about a steady decline in the debt ratios. What we have now with the worsening demography is a prospect of increasing public expenditures and debt ratios increasing. If you look at the latest data from the CBO's Congressional Budget Office and the Office of Budget Responsibility in the UK, the projection for debt ratios, even before the coronavirus struck, was for a virtually exponential increase in debt as far as the eye could see. Now, if you can't grow out of debt, and you won't because of the decline in the workforce, unless there's an absolute productivity miracle, none is in sight at all. If you can't grow out of debt, what do you do? The ability to increase the fiscal surplus enormously is, I think, politically impossible. The likely outcome is more inflation.
I think to some extent, at least initially for the first few years that you see inflation, first is I think the way central banks will see it is some kind of averaging out along the principles of price level targeting. Having struggled so hard to try and achieve the inflation target and having undershot that inflation target for a while, I'm not really sure the reaction is going to be immediate. But to your point, the question you're asking clearly is, won't that do damage to the economies at hand? I think given the debt levels that we have, and Charles just spoke about, many in the markets will actually not panic seeing inflation because they know, as Charles was saying, that this is one way that you can erode some of the real burden of debt. The second issue, I think, over here is that you will actually see some pro-cyclical action, if anything, from central banks, because while they have stepped back, particularly the Fed, from yield curve control at this time, this is a crisis in which fiscal policy is in the front seat, and central banks are playing the role of financing that fiscal policy because it is Main Street and not Wall Street that is the problem. Now, if yields start to rise as inflation starts appearing, and that challenges the task of financing fiscal policy, if anything, I think it is likely that central banks will come in and talk about instruments like yield curve control or ways to ensure that fiscal borrowing costs are kept lower. So if anything, they will have to find ways to convince markets and the economy that a small amount of bout of inflation is likely to be beneficial. It won't be for a while until people, I think, realize that inflation is here to stay. And at that point in time, I think we will see many economic and market features changing.
Absolutely correct. And initially, the response would be, it'd be marvelous that inflation has gone up to whatever it is, because this is averaging inflation. We're now on an averaging inflation objective. And that will go on for a year, 2 years, before it starts sinking in that this is not just temporary. And if you want to average inflation, or if you have an inflation target, that we're in now going to be in real trouble. That's when things will start really biting.
Manoj, you described how what you might call perhaps present concern is anesthetized by looking back at the example of Japan and seeing their past as prologue. But you alluded to the fact that there was a context in which the Japanese dynamics unfolded that is different than what's on the horizon. Could you expand on that a little bit to show us, illuminate why the Japanese example is not the essence or germane to the scenario that's in your book?
With pleasure. So when people look at Japan, they see an economy which struggled with growth for a very long period of time. The lost decade was something that is very, very much in the forefront of almost any economist or market practitioner as a period in which Japan had virtually no growth. They struggled with getting that growth higher. Inflation has slipped into negative territory. Wage growth has dropped. And overall, the Japanese economy has struggled to get out of that for decades, because of which Abenomics was seen as such a promising change that we're still hoping will play out. However, the context of the Japanese economy and its evolution is extremely important. And let me explain very simply what I mean by that. I tried to use a very simple example of just traffic congestion. I mean, if the main artery of traffic in whatever city you're in is clogged up, but the side roads are empty, very soon that congestion will be gone. However, if it's rush hour and every single street surrounding you is clogged up, there's very little you can do. Now, the first part is what Japan experienced. So what we see in the Japanese economy, first of all, is a reaction by the firms over there, which showed them to be actually very dynamic and not weighed down by leverage in a way that most people describe the theory of a balance sheet recessions. And a similar look at Japan seems to suggest that Japanese corporates were all but dead and left in the water. If you look at the way the Japanese corporate sector behaved in response to the global shock we've talked about, the evidence very much suggests that they were fully aware that there was a massive global disinflationary shock, a huge surge in the supply of labor, and outbound FDI was one of the key strategies that the Japanese corporate sector used to take advantage of this situation. And they invested heavily globally. The amount of manufacturing and services production that happened by Japanese corporates outside Japan's border actually compensates heavily for investment within Japan. Second, if you look at overall the productivity profile of the Japanese economy, the economy broadly grew around 1% at a time when its labor force was shrinking by around 1%. Now, if you gave the advanced economies today a chance at 2% productivity growth, it would very much be the kind of miracle that Charles spoke about that they would love to have in order to wear off some of the debt that they've got. None of that is in sight. So Japan has actually done very well over that period. And if you even if you looked at their inflation profile, there were certain disinflationary periods, no doubt. But overall, inflation and wages have done rather better than most people give them credit for. And if you take a closer look at the Japanese labor culture, the way they adjusted this shock was in two ways. Number one, rather than laying off people, as we all know, is against the custom of labor in Japan, the hours were reduced. And so employment remained fairly steady. And the second thing that happened was the increase in the use of part-time workers allowed this disinflationary pressure to be disseminated. So while part-time workers were not really on these lifelong contracts, their wages could be manipulated much more flexibly than that of full-time workers. And their increasing prevalence actually gave Japanese corporates much greater flexibility than we've given them credit for. So if you put all of that together, how dynamic actually the Japanese corporate sector was, how they used the global economy as an escape valve to try and take advantage of these global dynamics, how productivity actually evolved in Japan and how the labor market evolved, what it boils down to is just a very simple way of thinking, is to say that how could China have evolved the way it does with its terrific ascent and not created any effect or impact on the Japanese economy? In fact, if you look at METI statistics, a lot of the offshoring of production was actually sent onto Chinese and Asian shores, which suggests that Japan aggressively took advantage of the same global conditions, which then allowed a lot of the global dynamics to filter through into Japan. So rather than being a torchbearer for deflation, Japan took advantage of the disinflationary impulses and participated in a way to alleviate its pain. And if you're looking at what the global economy can do, I think the path is going to be very different, because not all of us will have those kind of escape routes anymore. Those are far more clogged up, which is kind of like the second example I was talking about.
One of the points that we're making in the book is that nowadays you really have to look at the world as a whole rather than concentrating on one single economy. And I would also add one minor point to what Manoj has most eloquently said about Japan, which is that the whole basis of outsourcing has been in the manufacturing goods sector, where labor had its strongest bargaining power and was basically most unionized. And what this globalization and shift of production to China has meant has been that the labor force in our other economies, Japan, US, UK, and the rest, has shifted into the service sector, where labor is much less unionized and is in a much weaker bargaining position. So this combination of globalization and demography over the last 30 years has weakened the bargaining power of labor enormously, which has been one of the key factors in leading to disinflation, inequality, and so on. And it will take a time for this to reverse, because the adjustment process is going to be slower, but reverse it will.
Manoj, I know talking heads macroeconomics looks at things in a big systemic way. I'm trying to imagine a portfolio strategy that you would share with your clients. Which equity sectors do you think will be relatively better off in a long-short combination or in absolute rise in response to all of these, what I'll call tectonic plate shifts that you two have envisioned and are not yet part of the consensus?
It's an evolving question for sure. It's a very good one. And Let me give you the punchline first before we talk about why. I think there are two ways to look at what an equity portfolio might include and what it might not. Number one, as Charles had put out in his discussion of caring, there's going to be an absolutely gigantic increase in the demand for healthcare for the elderly. Now, this segment of the population doesn't really get into social unrest in the way of physical violence, but they do vote. And so this is an extremely powerful lobby that will have a major demand on healthcare services. So I can't imagine any portfolio that is constructed over the next 30 or 35 years being short on healthcare. And since this is already a gigantic part of most economies, I think it will be liquid. It will be one in which you will find fruitful opportunities. Much is made of the very low productivity in sectors like healthcare and education, particularly in the United States. But we have to understand this is less a question of productivity in the sense of manufacturing and more about individualized attention to patients, which cannot be done away through robotics and AI. So if people have grandiose ideas that all of this is going to be done through AI, I think that will lead to some disappointment. The second part where you want to be long on the equity sector is parts of the economy that haven't already been mechanized and are open to such. And we are seeing a lot of that already happening. If you looked at the equity market in the last 3 months, clearly the coronavirus, again, as Charles put it, has fast-tracked many of the developments in tech. And tech has been leading the story because more and more we expect to see wherever productivity can be enhanced, by minimizing labor context over the next 10 years, that will happen. So I think identifying resources and manufacturing sectors in which tech can play a role, and we believe it has a very important and vital role to play in this, should be part of your long. And part of the short strategies, I think, will be the ones that depend on very growth-oriented revenue. So these growth stocks that tend to do well when we are under bursts of growth as we are right now will have to be rethought. And that will be a challenge, I think, going forward, because some sectors will do definitely better than others. The second part of that strategy you need to think about is where the administrative capital in the emerging market side has the potential to play into a portfolio. At this moment, the entire emerging market universe is under a shadow because as investors will tell you readily, there is neither growth nor yield on offer. And so what can be done to include these emerging markets on a fundamental basis in a portfolio today is very difficult to argue. However, over the next 20 or 30 years, given the demographic headwinds that we will see in the advanced economies, and the amount of physical change that can be brought about in EM, I think they will play an important role in portfolios. Don't forget that the way to enhance productivity is to have inefficiencies, and God knows emerging markets have plenty of those. One of the difficulties in the advanced economies is there are very few inefficiencies to release as such relative to EM. And the path that we are taking through mechanization, AI, and technology is fairly easily adapted to emerging markets. And so if you play both these parts of your portfolios well, I think you should be relatively safe in seeking long-run returns. One final point I'll make is not to forget the role of housing, because as a side point that we make in the book, we argue that the stock of housing in the economy is not really very flexible. The elderly don't like to move. They like to stay in the houses that they have bought and gotten used to, which means as younger families come into an income stream, they will use that to have to buy houses of their own, which will keep housing more supported than most people have given it credit for. So even if you see a demographic pressure, it's not clear to me that housing should do very badly over the next few years. And that gives us plenty to play with in equity portfolios.
Charles, you mentioned at one point in our conversation that you're probably both or each experiencing a great deal of feedback from people because your scenario is in quite marked contrast to the conventional wisdom. I remember when I worked in the Soros Fund Management, I used to talk with my partner, Stanley Druckenmiller, who I thought was a trading genius. And he said to me once that the way you make money is when the world believes one thing and you believe another, and you can see how they're going to change from their belief to yours. In other words, it's a cry in the forest doesn't change people's perceptions and therefore asset prices. You have to have a hypothesis about the timing and the catalysts of what will change the consensus from where it is to your unique vision that is not the consensus. I'm curious what kind of resistance you experience now, and I'm curious what you think will be the telltale signs that catalyze the awareness of this new dynamic and new consensus.
Unfortunately, the dynamics depend on what is likely to happen to the future of the coronavirus pandemic we're living through. As long as this continues, we won't, I think, get this kind of inflationary reversal. If we get a vaccine and becomes generally available to the population so that we put the pandemic properly behind us, then I think that inflation will set off within about a year of the pandemic being effectively over. The first year, as we've already mentioned, any increase in inflation, which we expect to happen, will be welcomed by central banks, and they will say simply that this is the desired reversal, which we've struggled to bring about, in offsetting the undershoots we've had in the past. It will then be about another year when the inflation, having risen, doesn't then fall back at the level of interest rates which the central banks will then continue to hold, that it will begin to be realized that the world is not, as those who argue for secular stagnation and lower for longer have argued, that we have changed to a new regime, a new world. So it's the change in markets, I think, will probably be, it depends if and when we get a vaccine, of course. But assuming that we do get a vaccine, it will probably be about 18 months after the vaccine becomes generally available.
Manoj, do you have further thoughts?
Just a couple of small things to look out for. I mean, for people who are following this on the market side, I would think that perhaps one of the most important indicators you can look at is break-even inflation. And so people who are not familiar with the fixed income side, this would be simply the difference between the treasury bond yield, say a 10-year treasury bond, and the interest rate on an inflation-protected security, so a TIP security. The difference between the two is often called by markets as break-even inflation. And that number, I think, is something that will give you a very good indication of which way these stories are going from a market point of view. Inflation itself will rise over a period of time. And if you look at the term structure, so how break-even inflation seems to the market to materialize over 1 year, 5 year, 10 year period, I think what you will begin to see from this will be a very interesting term structure exactly along the lines that we had discussed before, which is that an overall pickup in inflation that is not expected to persist very far out. It will go up to modest levels and only gradually then start increasing. But that second increase, when the gradual increase comes, is when the equity market will start wondering about valuations and how equities perform under scenarios where not everything is benign. So what markets have called Goldilocks scenario of low inflation, policymakers therefore very eager to plug in and provide as much monetary protection to the economy as they can provide without any fear of economic reprisals. That thesis will start to get assessed. And I think it is at that point in time that the productive and unproductive sectors of the economy will very much be differentiated in what I think will be a very different way of looking at those portfolios. So the evolution, I think, is coming, but break-even inflation will be an absolutely key benchmark to keep a track on, particularly in its term structure.
Well, I guess, Manoj, to use your firm talking heads economics, I've always brought to the thoughts of David Byrne and his most famous album, Stop Making Sense. But as I listen to the two of you, I'm reminded of one of my mentors, Rudy Dornbusch. He was a professor of international economics at MIT, where I was an undergraduate, and years later was a consultant when I was at Soros Fund Management. And he one day said to me that he didn't understand why, when he was the mentor to so many investors, that they all got paid so much more than he did. And I smiled at him. He was a very playful man. And I smiled at him and I said, Rudy, you are paid for your imagination to expand the range of scenarios and possibilities for someone like George Soros to consider. He's paid for picking the right model. And somehow there's a premium on picking the right model. What I'm fascinated by as I listen to you today, to use David Byrne's term, stop making sense, which is hiding in plain sight. You've used your imaginations and your analytic capacities to create a vision of something that just might be the right model in the medium term that I don't hear anyone talking about. So I'm trying to figure out, how would I say, the way in which the two of you might have both the imagination and the capacity to pick the right model. And there's some element in this which I must call something like independence or courage. There is a sense in which you have to free yourself from the reaction, the fear of the reaction of others, the fear of how other people are going to discredit you or what have you, to argue with you, in order to go to that place and express it with the vitality and the clarity that you have. And I guess that's a long-winded way of saying I admire the work that both of you are doing. I think the kind of challenge that you're bringing forward is at the core of what the Institute for New Economic Thinking was founded to engender. When people ask me, you know, what do you believe? What do they believe, et cetera? It's often that I don't believe one thing or another, though I do have my opinions. It's that I feel it's important to foment critical discourse. I feel through the courage, the tension, the dynamic, the interaction, and the respect that you engender, that we begin to learn and we begin to evolve and we have at least some potential to minimize mistakes or the damage those we're responsible for are forced to incur. But this book stands out markedly from the things that I've been exposed to, and I want to thank you both, not only for sharing it with us today, but also I want to thank you both for writing it and standing tall. Any final thoughts, Charles, Manoj?
All I can say is at the age of 84, you don't really care too much about whether other people disagree with what you think.
Well, Manoj, that means you and I shouldn't go get a job in a nursing home or we'll get beat up pretty bad, right?
Well, I agree. I will say that in some senses, I'm sure more people will write that. Charles is actually the wrong person to write this book because he's an intellectual giant. And if we can all work at half the capacity he has at his age, I think the world will be awash with productivity. Alas, some of us are not at that level, nor will ever be. For me, it's been an absolute privilege and a pleasure to work with him. And I have enjoyed every minute of it. So thank you for having us and thank you for your kind words. For me, it's been a brilliant ride.
And Charles, my old friend, I must say to you that that independence and that vitality and that courage has nothing to do with you being 84, because you've been that like that since the first day I met you. And you've always shared with people things they hadn't been thinking of. And the greatness that Manoj speaks of didn't start in the late 80s, though I can understand why you expressed it in that way. It's been a part of you for much longer.
Well, thank you very much, Rob. It's very kind. It's been a great pleasure being here and being able to talk with you. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you both. And as we move around the corner, past the presidential elections and into the, hopefully at some point, passageway beyond the acute coping with the pandemic, I'd love to have the chance to explore with you again. But for now, I want to say thank you from me and from all of our listeners, and goodbye.
Goodbye to you too.
Thank you. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.